From NPR Music, you're connected to All Songs Considered. I'm Bob Boylan, and this, of course, is The Rolling Stone. I hear you talk. Rocks Off is the lead track to Exile on Main Street, and this and the song that follows, Rip This Joint, is one of the best 1-2 punches in rock and roll. In fact, this double album, once thought of as a bit of a mess and too long, over time has become one of rock and roll's most important records. This week, a remastered version of Exile on Main Street is being released, along with a second disc that includes 10 never-before-released songs. NPR's Morning Edition interviewed Keith Richards and Mick Jagger about Exile, and we're talking with Don Was. Don Was has been producing the Rolling Stones since 1994, and he was tasked with going through the Exile on Main Street multi-track tapes to find remembered gems and lost songs. Don Was joins us from New York City, and I wondered if he was a fan of the record back in the day. Did you buy this record when it came out?
Yeah, sure, of course I did. I bought every Rolling Stones record the week it came out until we got to Voodoo Lounge, where I'd been the producer and already had a copy.
You got
a free copy.
So having bought all those others, and Sticky Fingers was the one previous, what'd you think?
It was kind of alarming, to tell you the truth. It was an unsettling record. I think it was really a reflection of the times, you know. I was in college at that time, mm-hmm. and there was a sense that the revolution had been lost. If there ever was one, it had been lost at this point.
This is 1972.
72, yeah. And Nixon was getting reelected, and bad things were coming. The war was still going.
You were probably 19.
Yeah, I was 20 in 1972, yeah. And I was living in Ann Arbor, Michigan, the birthplace of the SDS. So it was a pretty radical town, Students for Democratic Society. It was a hotbed of radicalism, and it was pretty clear that things weren't working. And there was this sense that we were heading towards something apocalyptic. What I felt was that Exile on Main Street was their version of Apocalypse Now, that these guys decided to get the hell out. And they were in this place with these palm trees and water. and they were running amok, you know? That is young guys with bread and cachet doing whatever they wanted to do. Somewhere between Colonel Kurtz and Lord of the Flies, you know? And that was my feeling about it. It had an apocalyptic feel to it. It had, just the sound of it is unlike anything you ever heard before. And some of the songs were, you know, I Just Want to See His Face. It's funky, but it's a weird thing for anyone to be making in 1972.
This song keeps building. It's almost as mm-hmm. if they were just sort of feeling it out and all in a room together playing.
Well, my image of it, you know, from the time was like there was some Haitian voodoo rock and roll ritual, you know. That was what I was conjuring up. I mean, it was highly evocative. You know, I got to say, I think that's one of their great talents, the Rolling Stones, is that they give you, they're very poetic and impressionistic. And they give you enough information to get directed, but they allow you enough room to project what you're going through in your own life at that time onto the songs. So this could, what the hell's this one about? It could be about anything, man, you know.
That's great. That's a great way to describe it. Good works art really do that. And,
I agree.
And, really engaging. Let's listen just a few seconds more. Do you want to describe, now that you know all these years later, where physically they were and what the room was that it was like? And
well, you know, I want to tell you something. I went through the multi-track tapes, which was kind of like watching a radio play. You know, I don't know what the room looked like. I've seen the same pictures everybody else has. I know they were in a basement in France. And in fact, last night I saw the documentary Stones in Exile for the first time.
Uh-huh. Which and is playing next week or some, right? It's on TV sometime?
I think it's on, yeah, Jimmy Fallon's airing it, but it's gonna show in at the Cannes Film Festival, and it'll be out as a DVD, I think, in June. And that gave me a little more sense of it, but I kind of don't want to know, literally. I still can't figure out where the drums were in relation to where the horns were, and I've seen the horn players sitting in this tiny little concrete room by them. It looks like a prison cell that the two horn players are in. And I don't have a sense of the layout of it. And I think I like it being mysterious. You know, it's whatever you want it to be. Right? That's the beauty of that record.
But you did get to peer into this world. Now, just tell us how that came about in a nutshell. The record label basically says, you guys ought to do something special for this record. What do they do? Ask Mick and Keith. They want to go through the
tapes.
Yeah,
they asked them for some bonus tracks. Yeah, some unreleased tracks from the period. And I think to them it was like asking, you mind if we put some splinters under your fingernails? It was just the last thing they wanted to do. So Mick called me as if he were asking me to do him a big favor and, you know, take on this burden. And I was so thrilled, man. You know, it's just like a dream to go through this stuff. And it was absolutely fascinating. I listened to probably 300 hours of Rolling Stones multitracks that were not really marked or logged, so I didn't know what was coming next.
Describe this thing. Somebody's got to get the tapes. Where were they? What comes to you? Where are you?
The tapes are stored somewhere in England in a warehouse.
Somewhere in England.
And picture the last scene of Raiders of the Lost Ark. Okay? It's like this mini Smithsonian warehouse that they have that really goes on for blocks. They've recorded, they're running tapes constantly.
You're not joking about that part. It really goes on for blocks.
I'm not joking about it. No, let me tell you something. I've produced, you know, five or six albums for them. There's an album called Bridges to Babylon that we did in 96. And there was so much 2-inch recording tape that we had to hire a day librarian and a night librarian at the studio whose sole thing was to keep track of everything. And when we wanted to do overdubs on a song, we had to go to the librarian to ask for the tape because no one could keep track of it. You couldn't pile it up. It took up a whole room. And that's just one album.
Wow.
So they've done this always. They just run tape.
Wow. And so you get these, I assume somebody, not you, goes through this warehouse, pulls out anything that might have had the name Exile. I'm just making this up, but you helped me flesh this out.
Yeah, I guess I got hard drives with multi-track sessions on it.
I listened
in bed mostly. You know, I had these hard drives on my laptop running Pro Tools, and just wherever I was doing other things at that period of time. So whenever I could find, you know, a couple hours, I just, you know, hotel rooms, whatever.
So it's a little less romantic. You didn't get the dusty tape. Somebody else took these, probably had to put them in a convection oven, I would guess, because the tapes from that period just fall apart.
It's a frightening sight to see it happen. The backing just rolls off and takes the music with it. Yeah, so it had all been baked and transferred under, I think, really good conditions, because it sounds amazing, actually. And they're so well recorded, the things from that era too. Some of the earlier songs come from Olympic Studios in London, and Glyn Johns recorded them, and they're on 8 tracks. Right, so the drums are mono, and you have to make decisions before you can take those mics and make a mono track. You have to decide to EQ and add the reverb and add the compression before it goes to tape. And then once it's there, you're stuck with it. So you have to have the courage to take a stand and make a decision and be willing to live with it. So everything's cut like that. On the version of Loving Cup, the outtake version, which also comes from Olympic, Mick and Keith's vocals are on the same track, already compressed, already EQ'd, already have echo on. So in a way, you bring the faders up and you've got that sound. You don't have to do a whole lot of work to make it sound like the period.
Can I play a little of that? I actually haven't heard this one yet.
Oh, it's a good one.
Yes, come on up. Come on up. face full of mud. With a face full of mud. Yes, I'm stumbling and I know my car won't start. Yes, I am fumbling and I know I play a bad guitar. Ah, oh, but I just wanna drink.
What are some of the main differences between this version for you?
Well, it's guitar based as opposed to piano based. Yeah. I think that's a big difference. It's slower, but I think there's something musically going on here that really exemplifies the greatness of the Rolling Stones. Right? Okay. Imagine this. If you're making records to a click track where there's a metronome counting exactly where the beats are, or you're doing what a lot of people do now, which is you do something called quantizing the beat. So one is exactly on one, and if someone doesn't hit the beat on the one, it moves it over to the nearest beat automatically in digital recording for you. So when everything's quantized like that, if you want to play in that musical universe, it's akin to diving off a diving board into a little flute of champagne. You got to land in that specific area or you sound really out of rhythm and it sounds really goofy and sloppy and messy. The beauty of the Rolling Stones is that because each of these five guys feels the beat in a little different place and no one's correcting it, if you want to play along with them, it's like diving into a lake, man. You got all this room for where the beat lives. If that makes, am I making sense?
Yeah,
is that clear?
Well, this band swung. I mean,
this band could swing, right. and Charlie is back behind the beat, and Bill Wyman's sitting there with him. Mick Taylor's a little bit on top of it. Keith's sitting, you know, closer to Charlie, but he's ahead of Charlie a little bit. And it's a nice, comfortable cushion for the music to land on, and. On this particular track, if we want to look at if we want to use the champagne flute analogy and see it expanding outwards where the musicians perceive the beat, there's some point where you expand so far out that you lose your momentum. The centrifugal force of rhythm that holds the song together breaks down, and it's just crappy, right? But if you push it in just a little bit from that point, you find the furthest point where you can still be funky. You know, Muddy Waters used to hit that with his band, you know, Willie Dixon and those guys, you know. They're an example of being loose. John Lee Hooker would hit that, where it's loose but funky.
And when when that beat hits, when Charlie's hitting, it snaps everything in this wonderful place, doesn't it?
It's incredible, man. Yeah. So this song to me represents the furthest frontier of how far the beat can be stretched
before it
falls apart. So this is just funky and low down, and it's everything rock and roll ought to be. I love this track.
You're a great listener. That's a great way to describe what's going on here.
I think when people love, you know, people love this album. Musicians have been influenced by this album for generations now. And where people sometimes get it wrong in trying to imitate it is they think it's sloppy. And it's not sloppy. It's got width, W-I-D-T-H, and depth to it. But it's not sloppy. And if you're going to try to imitate Exile by being sloppy, you're going to miss the point of it. You got to be funky first.
That's so great. What I'm not clear I understand is what you did. Okay, you went through all these tapes, but there's remixing, there's remastering, and we can explain that to people simply. I could let you do that. tell me what you did to the 18 tracks of the basic, forgetting the extra things for a minute.
I did nothing to them. I had nothing to do with any of that. You know, a guy remastered it, and that's, you apply a little equalization, EQ, like tone control. You add treble or bass in a more subtle way, and a little bit of compression and whatever. But
so nothing was done to the 18 tracks, or no, something was done to the original 18 tracks, and that was not you. That was somebody in England.
Yeah, but that was but to the mixes. No one messed with the balances or anything like that. These are just from the stereo mixes that were issued.
That's right. And that's what's called remastering, where you
remastering,
take the mixed tapes, and then I'm not telling you this, of course, but I'm just the right. So
you take the mixed tapes and treat them a little bit, which, by the way, they did in 1972. Right. A weird thing happened.
Not 72. No, 92.
Right? No. Even to release the record, you had to master it originally.
Oh, sure. But then it was remastered again later, right? Virgin.
It's been remastered. Now, I was involved in the remastering in 1993 or 94. Yeah. For Virgin Records. And that was quite an undertaking because there was absolutely no frame of reference. What happens is you do this original treatment, which mastering the equalization on it, and you try to balance out the volume levels so that if you're listening loud to a song, it doesn't blow up the speakers in your car on the neck, just little things like that. And you try to make really disparate mixes sound like they're of a piece. Mm-hmm. If you listen to the mixes of Exile on Main Street before they were mastered, it's a mess. Man. It doesn't sound like the Exile that we know. Okay, each mix is very different. So somebody went in there and mastered it for the original release and kind of brought some unity to the sound. There are mastered tapes of that version that nobody can find anymore. So when we went back in 1994, we had to say, well, here are the original mixes before they were mastered, but it doesn't sound anything like the Exile that we know. And then you start referencing the CDs that people put out in the 80s and stuff, and it doesn't sound anything like anything. It's terrible sounding, like some guy at a plant in Germany working the midnight shift decides it needs more treble, and he changes the record for perpetuity. Yeah? Right. So what are you matching to? What is faithful? What did these guys intend for you to hear in 1972? And finally, we put an ad in Goldmine Magazine, which is a record collector's.
Absolutely.
We answered an ad in the back of it. Okay. And we were recording at my house. We were doing Voodoo Lounge in my house in L.A. in 1993. And some collectors came around because we answered their ad because they had Virgin Vinyl 1972 copies of Exile on Main Street. And, of course, they show up at my house and Mick and Keith are there. And it was a great moment, man. So we played that and it sounded amazing. And we said, well, that's Exile.
Yeah.
Okay. Because even before CDs, when they start manufacturing these albums over the years and all over the world, people change it. People take tremendous liberties. It's almost impossible to maintain total quality control on the manufacture of records and CDs.
Now we have a reference point, and we
sent it to a guy named Bob Ludwig, who's the leading record mastering cat maybe in the world. And we told him to just copy it from the vinyl albums, and we'd put that out. And he had too much pride to do that, so he matched it up. And in 1994, it sounded great. It sounded very much like what they intended it to sound like in 1972. And this new remastering, I had nothing to do with, but I know the guy who did it, Stephen Markison, who's a great guy. And it's a subtle difference, but you can hear more top end and stuff. It sounds good.
Mm-hmm. And then your role, you're mainly going through and trying to find stuff they either forgot about.
On this new version of Exile on Main Street, the reissue, there's a second disc with 10 previously unreleased tracks that were unfinished for a myriad of reasons in 1972 and that have just been sitting around. And in searching through hundreds of hours of tapes, we finally narrowed it down to these 10 and we finished these songs. Some of them, many of them, just needed mixing. And Bob Clearmountain came in and tried to stay very faithful to what Andy Johns had done on the original 18 in 1972.
Andy Johns, the mixing engineer.
He was mixing. He mixed the album, recorded all the stuff in France, and his brother Glenn had recorded the 8-track stuff from Olympic Studios that marked the earliest recordings for Exile. And then some of them were in various states of disarray. The one that was in the most disarray is a song called Following the River, which is a beautiful track that never had a melody line or lyrics. And so Mick Jagger went back and wrote new lyrics and did a new vocal for it 40 years after the fact.
Well, let me take you back a little bit. I'd like to unfold that story just a little bit. You're going through hours and hours of tape, and you come across, what? You're listening to 16 tracks on a digital hard drive in a Pro Tools session, and you came upon this song. Tell me what it is you heard. So when we hear, I'll play some of it, but tell me what you heard, and then what you thought, and then how you presented it to Mick.
Well, they were aware of it. They knew that this existed, but they just had never done anything about it. And then I found the multi-track, and it was beautiful. I think the version that we originally had was kind of cut off. We only had a minute and a half of it or something like that. And that was one. They suggested about 40 possible songs to me, Mick and Keith.
Wow.
And that's when I started looking for those 40 songs. But in the process, came across other stuff. And came across a six-minute version of what became Following the River. It had another name. I can't remember the name of it now. But it's a piano-driven track featuring Nicky Hopkins. But everything you hear on the record, on the version that was released, comes from 1972, except for Mick's vocal, the background vocals, and some strings that we put on.
Let's listen to a little of this. This is Following the River.
There's something I should tell you. Why don't you sit there in that chair? You're looking good today. I love the way your comb's tucked in your hair. My cards are on the table, but the drinks have all run out. There's been some others in this room with me. Well, really quite a crowd. It's hard to break it gently, but I really thought it through. I don't think there's much future left for me and you.
So there's 38 years between Mick singing and Mick singing. What did you think of the quality of the voice between those two things when he tried to do this? And how did you get him to do this? I mean, really, the spirit is pretty there. At least I think.
Well, I think it's totally there. Although, to his credit, I must say that he did not try to write as if he were still 28 years old. He wrote from the perspective of who he is today. In fact, it was a very emotional session for me, because just hearing him, just watching him do it, the visual that came, I saw the video in my head, and it was him walking through that house in Nellcott, but today, and there were sheets over the furniture and that kind of thing, but it was him today walking through that house where they did the song 40 years ago. And I love what he did. We had certain guideposts in mind before we started. On one side of it was a fax that Keith sent me at the beginning that said, "You don't have to make it sound like Exile. It is Exile." I thought, "You're right. Good. Go gently here, man." And on the other side was a knowledge that people were going to pay money for this stuff, and that it'd be nice to give him something that would bear repeated scrutiny, something you'd actually want to play more than once, something that wasn't just aimed at musicologists, but was music you'd want to listen to over and over again, remembering that the 18 songs that made up the original Exile on Main Street all had the benefit of being sent to Hollywood afterwards, where they finished the record, and they did overdubs to it. And if he hadn't finished all the lyrics, he sang the new lyric on top of it. You know, so we decided let's make it good, let's make it listenable, but let's try not to do anything that destroys the spirit in which the tracks were intended in 1972. And I'm very proud of it. I think there was tremendous restraint, and I think we did a good job. For me, I tried to summon up the spirit of Jimmy Miller, who produced these songs, and I was constantly saying, well, what would Jimmy Miller have done? I felt I was his designated driver here. He couldn't be here, but right. I tried to always think of him and make him proud of these things.
Miller died
maybe before, 10 years ago.
Yeah. Was it before you start? Was it around the time you started working with it? Was it late '90s, middle '90s?
Well, he'd start. I think the last album Jimmy Miller did with him was Goat's Head Soup.
Okay,
but he lived another 20 years. He passed away somewhere in the mid '90s, I think. I never met him.
He's played some drums on Exile on Main Street. He's great.
He did. I think he plays Unhappy. Yeah.
Yeah. Great producer. Really great.
Great producer. You know, he's one of the reasons I became a producer. Huh. Was that I loved what he did, and I wanted his job. I wanted to do the same thing. It seems a very romantic way to spend your life.
It's a hard thing to pin down for people who have never made a record, but maybe if you say what it was that you heard in Jimmy Miller's work that made you want to do that, it would help people pin down what a producer really can do to a record.
Well, you can have a tremendous impact. It's something where I think you have to be careful. I think Jimmy Miller, you know, he was present as the Stones entered another era. It's hard to say how they made this jump from the early records to the sound of Jumpin' Jack Flash. You know, that song's got a thing to it that begins a new era of music for the Rolling Stones. And I like the fact that you can't clearly identify what, there's not a Jimmy Miller sound, you know, that he didn't leave a thumbprint on the foreheads of these giants of music, but just helped them be their best. I think that's what a record producer does. Mm-hmm. You enable the artist to operate at their best. You encourage them. And you should be a fan, too. That was the other thing. I was a fan of Traffic and of the Rolling Stones, and you should... You kind of make the record you'd want to buy.
Let's bring it back to Exile. There's a song, mm-hmm. one of the bonus tracks, is called So Divine, Aladdin's Story. I was really taken by this one more than others. You could see why, in many ways, it didn't fit on the record. I mean, tonal, mm-hmm. There's something very different about it. In fact, the guitar line reminds me of Painted Black. Mm-hmm. It's a lovely, lovely song. Let's give a listen to this. You can tell me a bit about it. Yeah. Are these all original tracks that you found?
Yeah, except that there are punches in the vocal. There are places where he didn't sing a line. And I've forgotten now, and which is a really good sign. I think everything we heard up to that point was original.
Can I just try again maybe on the next one, see what happens, and then just bolt in here. Blue short.
I think that's a new line.
That's Jim Price on the vibraphone with him. And who's that? Bobby Keys on sax?
Bobby Keys, yeah, sure.
Jeez.
I really can't remember which lines I punched in.
I thought there was a teensy more sibilant clarity on the, yeah, the voice, but yeah.
I think it's the way he turns the phrase.
Doesn't sort of matter, yeah.
He's developed more technique over the years, and he holds out the notes a little longer. He can put a little vibrato on the end of it now, but it's pretty seamless. It's in keeping with the spirit of the original.
It's a great deal of fun. Anything you want to before we let you go? Anything you want to point out that you particularly either were surprised by, particularly proud of, or story to tell you may have missed?
Well, as a bass player, uh-huh, I think it would be remiss not to mention what an innovative, original, and unique bass player Bill Wyman is. I've never met Bill because I started working with him in 93, right after he'd left. Huh. And this certainly is not to disparage Daryl Jones or Brian Jones or anyone else who might have played bass on the records. Yeah. But there's something that he does, the way his approach to the instrument. It's really unique, man. He's kind of like a guitar player. But just when you think he's doing all this unbass stuff that a guitar player would do, he'll turn the phrase around with something really funky, like James Jamerson, Motown kind of phrase. And it's just genius, man. And it's such a large part of the sound of the band from that period. It's the weaving in and out. It's it's playing melodic lines and then jumping back into something rhythmic and then sitting on a note for a long time. To be very honest with you, there's a song on here called Dancing in the Light. And at one point, just sitting by myself, I thought the bass part at points was a little out of the pocket. And I thought, man, I'm a bass player. Let me just plug in and fix this. And I tried for about 2 seconds. I tried. I couldn't get his tone. I couldn't even get into his head. I don't know what the hell he's doing. I don't know what's going through his mind when he plays. He's a really unique bass player, but it's one of the cornerstones of this particular period in Rolling Stones' musical life.
That's great. Well, we'll go out on that song, Dancing in the Light, from the bonus track from Exile on Main Street. Thank you, Don Wilson.
Yeah,
thank you
great
so
to talk
much.
To you, Bob.
Yeah, great to talk to you, too. Be well.
See you, man.
Bye. You can hear some bonus tracks from Exile on Main Street at NPR.org through the end of May. And you can also hear an interview with Mick Jagger and Keith Richards about their Exile on Main Street memories. It's All Songs Considered.
Sitting in the darkness, you're dancing in the light. You're really at the big time. I really took a dive. I'm running in the rain. You're dancing in the light. Waiting for the train that never will arrive. You left me twisting in the wind, dangling in the night. You're my Mr. Christian, and I began to fly. Look at you with your face all shining. Got some new work, got some realigning. Now that your nose got some redefining. See you.